long, long time ago, in a land not too far away, there once existed a civilization that would soon be all but forgotten. From around 5,000 BC to 3,500 BC, this prehistoric culture was one of the most prosperous in the world, and yet its history remains largely shrouded in mystery. The civilization is being called Old Europe, and although it's often overshadowed by Egypt, Mesopotamia, Greece, and even Rome, the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University proposes that Old Europe is equally as intriguing and culturally rich. Now through April 25th, the Institute, which is located just steps away from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is presenting an exhibition called The Lost World of Old Europe, the Danube Valley, 5,000 BC to 3,500 BC. And I'm very pleased that it brings the Institute's executive director, Dr. Jennifer Chi, and Dr. David Anthony Guest, the show's guest curator, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Jennifer, there are over 250 prehistoric objects in the show that are being exhibited for the first time in America.
That's right.
Is there a reason they haven't been shown in this country before?
Well, I think that there wasn't a lot of dialogue between the countries that we were borrowing from and American institutions before our exhibit. We worked with Romania, Bulgaria, and Moldova. And while they had exhibitions of material both in their countries and there were a few exhibitions in Europe, there just wasn't an interest or really an understanding of this material in America. It's not taught in American universities, the subject of Old Europe. So we really wanted to bring it to an American audience and allow them to experience it.
So is that where the civilization arose, in Romania, Bulgaria, Moldova?
The heart of that civilization is located in Romania, Bulgaria, and Moldova. But you find evidence of it from Serbia all the way through to the Ukraine.
Wherever the Danube flows.
That's right.
Most of these pieces must be priceless. How did you get so many museums to contribute them?
It was a challenge. It definitely was a challenge. We organized this exhibition in a year and a half, and we had one lending institution in Romania, the Museum of National History, which was our organizing partner, and worked with all of the other Romanian institutions that lent to us. And then we worked with a central museum in Moldova and also the Varna Archaeological Museum in Bulgaria.
Now, David, what exactly does the term Old Europe mean?
Old Europe is a simple way of referring to what was really a very complicated series of cultures. So it's a sort of a blanket term.
Well, I've always thought of the Indo-European groups that later conquered all sorts of territories south as coming from this Danube Valley. Is this related in any way?
It is related. I've recently written a book, The Horse, the Wheel, and Language, on Princeton University Press, which is about exactly that, the origins of the Indo-European languages. And the position that I take in that book, and that is at least suggested in this exhibit, is that the speakers of Indo-European languages, and English, the language we're speaking now, is, of course, an Indo-European language, that the speakers of Indo-European languages originally lived in the grasslands, the steppes, to the east of the lower Danube Valley. Mm-hmm. And they may have played a role in the end of Old Europe in terms of bringing it to an end. But Old Europe was a completely distinctive and different agricultural civilization.
And where does this civilization, 5,000 to 3,500 B.C., stand in the civilization timeline? How does it compare to Mesopotamia, for example?
Mesopotamia, the first cities in the world, were just rising in Mesopotamia just as Old Europe was coming to an end. So Old Europe, the height of Old Europe was just before the rise of civilization in Mesopotamia.
So now, this predates the area that we say was the beginning of civilization?
It predates the cities. There were agricultural towns in Mesopotamia at the same time that Old Europe was there. But they didn't have nearly the riches that we see in Old Europe and that are on exhibit in this
show. Was Old Europe also structured around agricultural towns?
Yes. Oh, yes. They had a very rich agriculture. The towns were, at the time they were occupied, actually the largest human settlements in the world belonged to Old Europe. Some of them were more than a kilometer across and contained thousands of structures.
Wow. Do we have any idea what those structures look like?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because archaeologists have been digging them there. Old Europe is new to us, but it's not that new to the archaeologists of Romania and Bulgaria and Moldova, and they've been digging up these houses for many decades.
Jennifer, in the exhibition catalog, you say that old Europe is more or less skipped over in discussions of prehistoric Western civilizations.
That's right.
Because of where it was located?
I don't think it's necessarily where it's located. I think that it's in part due to the communist heritage of these countries. There was a lack of communication going on between the West and between these Eastern European nations for a very long time. And when these surveys were being produced, if you look at Janssen's History of Art, that material was really not accessible. And the languages that the material is published in, Romanian, Bulgarian, is still not accessible. So we're trying with this exhibition and with the exhibition catalog to give old Europe a place and really introduce it to a Western or American audience.
But weren't some of these artifacts already in areas that were not communist? So they were in German museums and other museums. What theories did people have about them at that time?
You're right. Some parts of southeastern Europe were more open to Western scholars than others. I excavated on an old European site, a site of Da Vinci culture, in 1977. But that was in the former Yugoslavia, what is today Serbia. And Western scholars could dig in Yugoslavia, even during the days of the Cold War. But it was impossible to dig in Romania or Bulgaria or Moldova.
Now, was there a lot of interaction between the different cultures of old Europe? Because we're not talking about one unified culture here, are we? But we do see distinct similarities.
There are very distinct similarities between the cultures that constituted old Europe, yeah.
What are some of the things that they did that were unique? You mentioned agriculture earlier than Mesopotamia. Were they involved with creating metal? This is pre-Bronze Age, isn't it?
It's Copper Age. It's Copper Age. They actually invented metallurgy. Probably without much or possibly without any influence from the Near East. They're sitting on top of some of the richest copper mineral deposits and gold deposits in all of Europe. And they discovered those, and because their pyrotechnology, their control over fire, was so sophisticated, and that had come about because they made this beautiful pottery. And the kilns were so sophisticated, they could raise the pottery up to very high temperatures. And those high temperatures are exactly the same high temperatures you need in order to turn copper ore into metal.
They did two-tier kilns?
They did two-tier kilns.
How did they come up with something like that?
I think they were driven by pottery, and you'll see this if you come and see the exhibit. Pottery for them wasn't just a utilitarian object. It was an object of beauty. And they invested a lot of creativity in decorating and making these very large and beautifully decorated pots. It was part of keeping up with the Joneses, really. I imagine that when these households had feasts and seasonal celebrations, that they brought out this beautifully decorated stuff sort of to impress the neighbors.
Among the first things that modern humans got involved with was making jewelry, especially from shells. Wasn't the spondylus shell really important in old European trade?
Yeah, the history of the agricultural civilizations of old Europe was that they originally started in Greece on the shores of the Aegean Sea, where the spondylus shell is found. And because of that history, they maintained an access to spondylus shells, and they funneled these beautiful shells from the Aegean up through southeastern Europe and all the way to France and Germany and Poland.
So that's how we learn a lot about what happened in the ancient world, by seeing things that we know come from one specific place thousands of miles away.
Exactly.
Yeah. My guests are Dr. David Anthony Guest, who is the guest curator of a show called The Lost World of Old Europe, the Danube Valley, 5,000 BC to 3,000 BC, and also Dr. Jennifer Chi, who is the executive director of the NYU's Institute of the Ancient World, which is presenting an exhibit that is just fabulous. It's also a wonderful catalog. A large portion of the show, Jennifer, focuses on miniature figurines that archaeologists believe depict women, similar to the famous Venus of Willendorf. These kinds of figurines are fairly ubiquitous in all ancient European cultures.
I wouldn't say all ancient European cultures. I'd say with old Europe, What's very interesting is there is a prolific production of these female figurines. You don't see them produced as much in other regions or at other time periods. And that's actually a question that we present. Why does this happen and what does it mean in old European cultures?
And do we have any idea of what function these things served? They are quite explicitly sexualized representations of women, aren't they?
That's true. And well, when you look at them, there's an obvious connection to fertility and fecundity. The female anatomy is often exaggerated. They are frequently found in domestic context. You see them buried next to hearths or within an area in which we know that women were working. And there are some interpretations that suggest that within old Europe there was some sort of matriarchy or a mother goddess phenomenon related to that matriarchy. And we definitely present this idea, but we also present alternative views based upon contextual readings of the actual pieces.
Well, when looking at something that goes back 7,000 years, it's pretty hard to figure out exactly what people thought.
It's true because we're looking at a prehistoric culture. We don't have any written sources that elucidate any of their practices, their social ritual practices, political practices. And so what we largely rely on are interpretations of objects within their context. And that's something that we like to stress at ISAW when you're looking at ancient art, that you should really look at the context of the object to understand even partially its meaning.
Now, David, you talked about the houses. Actually, when they're reconstructed, they look kind of modern, don't they?
Yeah, some of them.
We recognize them as houses.
Absolutely. Some of them are two stories. They're rather large houses, multi-room. There are ovens and fireplaces, sleeping areas, work areas, and then there seem to be some areas that are set aside for these ritual observances where the female figurines are used.
It's interesting when you go to the southwest and you look at the Anasazi ruins and you see these multi-story buildings, people are always impressed and think, wow, how did they come up with that? That looks like a modern apartment house. But
people were doing that
7,000 years ago.
Yeah, people have been building houses for a long, long time.
But not just huts or holes or thatch over them.
These are fairly sophisticated structures. They were grouped into settlements that had streets running down. Now, this was before the invention of the wheel. It's before the invention of writing. So the streets were for foot traffic. But their cattle and their sheep would have been coming up and down the streets.
So they were already domesticating animals as well? It wasn't just growing
absolutely.
Crops?
Absolutely. And there are animal figurines in the exhibit, figurines of cattle and sheep.
Extraordinary variety.
Yeah.
What can we learn about these cultures, Jennifer, from the pottery, which seems to have played such an important part? Role in this culture.
I think David is right that there was an extraordinary amount of effort placed into the production of this pottery. One aspect that we try to stress with the exhibition is that the typology of the pottery is very advanced. You have so many different shapes and variety, very large, very small, some that seem to be used just for display. And so there is a very strong sort of notion that these were used in some sort of ritual in the house. They could be used for storage, but there had to be feasting going around when used the vessels.
I've compared them actually to Victorian table settings, how elaborate Victorian table settings got. And the function of a Victorian table setting was not just to eat or to put the food in your mouth, but to display to everyone else who was there the fact that you knew which fork to pick up at the right time. And there's, in the same way, there's a wide variety of different vessels and vessel shapes and lids and stands.
And decorations.
Decorations.
You go from geometric, very stylized geometric patterns at the beginning of the 5th millennium BC, and you move towards greater abstraction, and then you actually see at the end of the production, you see figurines actually, or figures represented on the pottery, which is interesting.
And if you were to see it just a pot without knowing where it came from, would you pretty much be able to place it?
Yes. That's one of the things. The ceramics of old Europe are really distinctive. And one of the odd and interesting things about old Europe is that the pottery was more sophisticated during this period than it would ever be again in later European prehistory, and really until you got to the classical era.
Well, it also suggests that family and entertainment were really important, because you wouldn't have all these things if people weren't eating together a lot.
Exactly.
One of the most well-known objects from the exhibition is a male figurine archaeologists have called the Thinker, because it's in a similar pose to Rodin's sculpture of the same name. Where was that found?
That was found in a grave, actually, which is with its companion. There is a supposed male and a supposed female for the Thinker. Although, I have to say, if you take a good close look at the Thinker, he's got breasts.
Mm.
And it was only in this exhibit, because he's leaning forward It's always been called a he, but in an exhibit like this, you can walk right up to it and look very closely, and you can see that he has breasts. So
that
I wonder.
That might be a controversial interpretation, David.
It does look a bit like pre-Columbian art, doesn't it? Or maybe that's.
There's, you know, what I was so struck by when I visited for the first time Romania and Moldova and Bulgaria is that there's an extraordinary affinity to modern sculpture. Just modern art in general.
Henry Moore.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the Thinker and his wife, I've had so many people tell me that that's what they immediately think of, a Henry Moore sculpture. So, and then some people, particularly with the anthropomorphic vessels that we show in the exhibition that show all sorts of poses from daily life, people do say that these look pre-Columbian. So there's a varied aesthetic.
A listener wants to know if they were made without a wheel, the pottery.
Yes, the early pottery was made entirely without a wheel. The later pottery, they introduced a slow wheel, not a fast wheel.
We have a slideshow on our website of some of the works that are in the exhibit. My great thanks to Dr. Jennifer Chi, director of NYU's Institute for the Ancient World, and Dr. David Anthony, the guest curator of the show. The show is called The Lost World of Old Europe, the Danube Valley, 5000 BC to 3500 BC. Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking us.
Thank you.